Julian Good joins me now. Julian is a digital content and social media expert. We're going to be talking new media and the world of sport. But the first question I think we all want to know, Julian, is the expanded Twitter word limit. Your thoughts on that?
It's handy, you know, it gives you a chance to express yourself a bit better, but for those you follow that you don't really like, you're just going to see more of it, so I guess it's going to be a bit annoying. But you know, it allows for more of the good stuff, more humour, more emoticons, more hashtags, and people to write maybe a bit more using proper English rather than you know, shortening your words and abbreviating too much. So maybe it'll be a good thing, but it's going to fill up your Twitter stream a bit quicker, isn't it, Chris?
Now, I would say that Twitter and a lot of the social media things have kind of changed the landscape in terms of especially the job that I do. I mean, how else would I know? I'll give an example. Brentwood Rugby Club today, 19-0 victors against Southend Saxons in the Essex Cup. A few years ago, I might not have known about that, or it would have taken a few phone calls to find that. Now they just tag me in and it's straight there and I can see it. How important is it for a sports club, no matter its size, to have a presence in new media?
Well, I think you're right, Chris. It's taken as red now. You know, if you're a professional club, you know, a Chelsea, a Man United, or a big sports governing body, FA, ECB, whatever, then you just have to do it. It's part of being in the sports business. But if you're a smaller club, it gives you the chance to be a visible part of your community. And you're right, it's just grown so dramatically in the last 15, 20 years. So going from everybody eventually had to have a website, and then it's grown to the use of audio online, video online, live audio, live video, social media, and it's now keeping up with so many different social media channels, so that the numbers are huge for your big beasts, your Barcelona, Man United, Real Madrid, and your American sports multi-million followers. But even down at a local level, if you look at Brentwood Town are playing outside at the moment. You know, there's probably 100 people out there on a cold November day, but they've got 5,000 people on their Twitter feed. Billericay playing in front of 1,300 people on average this season. They've got over 20,000 people on their Twitter feed. So it just gives you a chance to put your message out to a bigger audience, and you can get through the ground on a match day. And it's the future. The BBC Sport football survey that came out this week said that kids now get 75% of their sports news via social media. So if you're not out there putting your news and information out via social feeds, your fans of the future aren't going to be hearing from you.
Now, anyone who knows goes online, you see there's so many networks, there's so many outlets that you've got. You've got apps, you've got website. What, as a sports club of any size, and we're talking a small sports club as first, what networks has a club got to get on? What is the bare minimum?
Oh, I think it's the bare minimum. It's Twitter and Facebook, because they're the one most people use. I think if you are able to produce a bit of video content, then you do YouTube as well, just because it allows you to get out and it will just increase your reach, because of, you know, the tie-in with Google and being found on search engines. If you are able to produce pictures on an ongoing basis, then you look at Instagram, but increasingly there's video on there. And Instagram taps into your youth audience as well. And if you're really looking at a youth audience, not really my demographic, but you're looking at Snapchat, and you look at some of the creative ways that clubs in this country or those with a bit more money, and again, going back to the States again, are using Snapchat and Instagram, it's frightening how creative they can be there. But then you've got niche channels. You know, for live video, you might have used Periscope before. Now you might just use Facebook. And if you're a football club and you want to hit an audience in China, then you've got particular networks in particular areas of the world that allow you to do the things you want to do. And then it's using the technology that's now presented to you. So, 10 years ago, you were probably just putting text out on your Twitter feed. You know, today, Brentwood Town are putting out pictures on there. I follow a local club, Horsham. I heard your name, checked them earlier. They scored at Greenwich Borough this afternoon. I went on my Twitter feed before I came in here, and I've seen the goal they scored because somebody's put it out on their official Twitter feed. So it just moved on so quickly. But it's great. You're right. You can keep up with so many things. Just finding the time to keep across all of it all. And as a club, it's finding the time to do it all and do it well. It's a challenge, but it's a big opportunity as well.
But I suppose one of the key things is as well is finding what should be shared, what you should share, and I suppose the tone of what you should be talking about, because a number of clubs have gone with different tones. You get accounts that have got a very corporate tone to them, and certainly at Isthmian level, you've got tones that are the spokesperson. They're the guy in the street. I mean, talking about Hyde United a few years ago, we're making jokes about their own team and how badly they were doing, in fact.
Yeah, and I think that happens. I mean, being honest with it, at non-league level, most clubs' Twitter feeds and Facebook feeds are being done by fans, done by volunteers for the club, who probably haven't got a press officer or anybody to do it for them officially. Yeah, there is a tendency for sports governing bodies, especially more than big football clubs, to sound a bit corporate, but you know, as people have become more professional in the digital world and the social media world, you know, it's all about getting the right tone across and using that effectively. But finding time to be humorous and finding time to be conversational and engaging, if you're a sports club, you've got to employ the right people to do it in the right way that suits you. And at times that may change, and there's always going to be serious issues in your sport and your club, and there's going to be times to be fun and jubilant, and there's times when, you know, you get a drubbing at home and it's not easy to do anything effectively, and you just have to sit there and take some of the blows that are given to you. But that, you know, that's part of the engagement, that's part of the conversational side, and you have to take those knocks as well sometimes.
So how important then is that conversational side? Because I suppose some people would treat it as, especially we talk social media, as a pin board, a church notice board, and then don't expect and don't necessarily interact with people coming back. How key for a sports club is it to have that back and forth with people?
Oh, it's hugely important. I think that's what makes social media different to just having your website. Your website is more your traditional notice board for your news and information and your background information about yourself as a sports club. Social media, you're out there. The opportunity is to be engaging, is to be conversational. It's to put stuff out there that starts conversations. It's for joining conversations with your fans and tapping into ways that allow you to build your audience. But it's doing things, you know, putting votes out there for your player of the season or your man of the match. It's asking people, you know, how they're going to watch you on TV. If you're Billericay Town this week, where in the world are you watching us from? It's how are people getting to your game on a Tuesday night? Where are people following you from in the world? It's all that kind of stuff that lights you up and creates a buzz around you that allows you to do things to build a positive image of your club and, you know, then benefit from some of the upsides, whether that's then getting a few more people through the turnstiles, whether it's selling, you know, a few more bits of merchandise, or whether it's giving you a bit of a commercial knock on as well that allows you to put sponsors on your infographics for your team sheets at the start of a game, or retain some of the sponsors that might look to go elsewhere in difficult economic times, because you can name check them more and you can say to them, you know, we are Billericay Town, we've got 20,000 people follow us on Twitter. You know, that's got to be of more benefit than back 20 years ago when, you know, all you had was really the people that were coming through the turnstiles on match day and looking at perimeter advertising boards and buying your match programme. You've got such a different audience that you can tap into week in, week out. And it's not just around match days, it's obviously, that's what's, you know, great about sport. It's that curve through up to match day, down again, and looking straight ahead to the next match day. There's always something you can be talking about behind the scenes to make people want to engage with you and come along, be a fan now and in the future.
So what are the there's some no-nos. We've seen it go wrong in the past. What would you say are your warning signs? Where can you go wrong on this?
Well, I think, you know, the trouble with social media is you do it quickly in error and then you regret it at length afterwards, and there are lots of instances that we won't shame anybody, but people, you know, you make spelling mistakes that people laugh at, you put things out there that you probably shouldn't do, talking about your opponents, and I think you've just got to be careful. I think you always think, count to 10 and think, you know, do you really want to be posting that? And you know, it's hard because you can't win all the time. Literally, you can't win. If you're a club or a sports governing body, you can't win all the time. So you're going to lose, and sometimes you won't approach that defeat in a way that fans find acceptable. You know, whether it's they want your manager to go or they don't think you picked the right players. And you've got to take some of those criticisms on the head. But sometimes, because it's a conversation, you can talk to people online and you can get your point of view across. And sometimes you can, you know, turn people around and make them see what it was you were trying to do and why you were trying to do it and why it wasn't so bad maybe in the first place. But, you know, sometimes it can be unpleasant. You know, social media gives everybody a voice, and sometimes some of those things you've got to listen to will be hard to take for you individually running social media for your club or your sports governing body. And sometimes you just have to sit back and let it wash over you and move on to hopefully the next win the next weekend.
You mentioned there with Horsham earlier, what about score updates? What would you say to the people who believe that it's, and there has been a few people in the past that believes it dampens attendances, why go and see your local team when in fact you can just catch the latest on Twitter from inside in the warm and then watch the highlights, watch the goal as it goes in? That's, I mean, it is certainly, certain chairmen in the past have thought that way about what they share and what they put out for people, and it's been the same argument that they've put out with local radio and people doing free audio streams of matches.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. You know, I don't think there's any conclusive evidence that shows that content on social media has a you know, downward effect on sports attendances, but clearly, if you know, you go to the other extreme, live video of matches is clearly perceived to have a downward effect on it, which is why there's no, you know, live games being broadcast this afternoon while all the matches are in progress, and that's long been the case. Personally, you know, being at a match, it's so much better than ever even just watching it on TV, let alone sitting watching it on Twitter. It wouldn't be a consideration for me. But yeah, maybe there are one or two people when you get into midwinter that might think, do I really want to go out away from the fire, and I can just sit there and watch it, listen to you on the radio and get updates, follow it on social, get a bit of that mix. It's a no-brainer to me. I'll always make the effort. I'm always going to go. But then I'm a Brighton fan, so it's always wonderful down at the Amex. Chris, sorry, West Ham fans, don't turn off. But, you know, I don't think so. I think it's always, as long as you do it in the right way, it's always creating a positive image around your club. And I'd like to think that, you know, if you follow it one day on Twitter and you see those, you know, if you're able to do it because of rights issues, put out bits of video, put out nice infographics about your club, some of those people will want to come along in the future because they like what you're saying and they like the atmosphere you're creating online and they want more of it.
Now, we've talked about clubs and corporate entities. What about players, managers, coaches? Should they be on social media as a general rule, or is it just asking for trouble?
Well, I think they are on social media. I think those days of governing bodies or sports clubs trying to stop their players being on social media are long gone. Everybody's on there. You know, there are one or two at each club that aren't, but, you know, whether managers should be on there, I don't know. If I was a chairman, maybe I wouldn't want my manager on there, but then there's so many chairmen that are on there as well who may or may not be asking for trouble by opening themselves up like that. But, yeah, all your players are out there and they're doing it personally, whether they're at your club or not, and they're going to be doing it, you know, when they move on to the next club, and they've probably been doing it, you know, before they were even playing football professionally, because, you know, everybody's been on there for the last decade. You know, social media gives everybody a voice. So that's the beauty of it. Whether you're a Billericay fan, a Brentwood fan, a fan of an NFL team, you can find most of your players on social media and you can see what they want to say about your team, about their sport and about things in their private life. And it just allows you to satisfy some of that need we all have to feel we want to get closer to our stars, the people that we love, you know, on the pitch and off the pitch. I think that's got to be a good thing. There is a downside to it, and some people, you know, don't act as well on social media as they should do, but they probably don't act as well as they should do in offline as well. I wouldn't want to be out there as a professional footballer like Ronaldo with 60 million followers and some of the things that must come their way. At that level, they're probably having all their social media feeds managed for them anyway professionally. If you're an average Championship, League One or non-league footballer, you're doing it all yourself, and it can't be easy sometimes to see what some people must post to you if you don't play well. Hopefully you just take it, move on, and go out and prove the wrong the next week.
We're joined in the studio this afternoon by Julian Good. He is a digital content and social media expert. We're talking new media and the world of sport this afternoon. And now we move on to trolls. Now, if it's not a matter of a player not playing well, a player being involved in a contract dispute, it's your team not winning. I'll give an example. Leighton Orient not won a league game for 11 league games. You're going to get a lot of heat online, a lot of things saying sack the manager, sack this, sack that. How do you deal with trolls? Is it a case of just ignoring them and hoping they're going to go away?
I think to some degree it is. There are some people you just can't deal with online, offline, and they're always going to cause you problems. I think it's different for a player, as a personal individual. If you're getting personal abuse, then you know that can't be easy. And I think your best advice is just to ignore it, block people, move on, and have conversations with those of you that want to deal with you in a civilized way online. If you're a club and you're going through bad times, then you know people get out of hand, and I'm sure they'll say some things in the heat of the moment or over a prolonged period of being in the heat of the moment that is over the top and shouldn't be tolerated. I think you have to take a view that you're going to get criticism if you're doing badly and not living up to expectations. Clearly those expectations differ, you know, if you're an Arsenal fan to being an Orient fan, and the degree of success you think your club should be having, and you've got an opinion about it, and if you're not in the pub shouting at people over the bar about it, then you're on social media venting, and sometimes you should think otherwise. I think as a club, just sit there, engage with those you think you can have a civilised conversation with, and maybe it'll help, maybe it'll placate a few people, maybe it'll help get your point across. Others, you won't win. You know, don't be afraid to block people and move on. If I think you set a standard on your social media feed for what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable. You have a policy that you stick to, and if people, you know, break the rules that you've set, foul language, you know, homophobic abuse, whatever it is, you don't allow that. That's not acceptable. If it goes well beyond the nature of what's acceptable, then you hand it over to the authorities, the people running those social feeds or elsewhere, to let it be dealt with. Otherwise, just block and move on. There's, you know, time's too short. People can't behave, then, you know, you can't help them, really, to be honest, sadly.
Now, by now, people are probably shouting at their radios, yeah, but what does Julian really know about social media and new media? You know, I'm billing you as an
good
expert
question on
digital content and social media. You've been working for 30 years in journalism and the digital industry,
haven't
you?
That sounds a very long time. Yes, I have. Yeah, I started off as a sports journalist back in the 90s when, you know, print media was still big and there were still local newspapers. I covered Bath City, I covered Man City for local papers. I ended up working on National Wire Service. Happily for me, when Graham Taylor was England manager, so the pinnacle of my sports journalism career was covering England during the not quite so glorious World Cup qualifying campaign when they didn't make it to America in 94. And then I jumped into what was very, you know, still an emerging new media world back in the late 90s to launch the first website for Lord's Cricket Ground for the MCC and the ECB, and ended up running digital media for the England Wales Cricket Board for 15 years or so, up until a couple of years ago. And now I work for myself, I'm self-employed, so that's a mix of journalism, consultancy work, still in the sports digital world, and increasingly doing social media, digital media for businesses here in the Brentwood, Essex area, because, you know, the same principles that you use around how to run your websites, how to run your social media, using high quality content, you know, they really apply to whatever sphere you're working in, whether it's, you know, running a business on Brentwood High Street or running Brentwood Town Football Club. You still want to do things in the right way to benefit your business, you know, whatever your objectives are, getting people through the turnstiles or selling more of your product.
As you say, probably one of the worst times to be an England football reporter, wasn't it, at that point?
It wasn't great, yeah. So, but, you know, I've seen England lose in lots of interesting places. I've saw them, you know, letting a goal after 10 seconds against San Marino and Bologna. But, you know, still covering your national team was still fantastic. Loved it. Got to travel around Europe watching England play. I'd be doing that while I was doing it as a fan beforehand. And I've done it since as a fan. So getting paid for it was you know, pretty great, Chris, to be honest.
Now, we talk about when you ranker in sports news desk at UK News, and then you jumped into the world of new media, as you say, in the late 1990s. Tell us about the landscape at this point, because when I was growing up, it seems strange now to say there wasn't really that many websites, and if you wanted to find something, it was really difficult to try and find anything.
Yeah, well, that I went to Lords in 1997, so they launched that website then, and they were one of the first governing bodies in the UK to launch a website. The FA was well behind. It took a long time for football clubs to get going, and some of the bigger clubs in this country took a long time to get going. And it grew and it grew. And I'd say it wasn't really until the middle of the noughties that kind of everybody was doing it to some degree. So there was, you know, there was a 10-year lag there of people doing it, not so well in some cases. And it took for, that bit of a snowball for people running sports clubs and people in commercial departments of sports clubs and sports governing bodies to think, hang on a minute, you know, everybody's starting to do this. We've got to do it properly, and we've got to resource it. And it's not easy, you know. If you are a sports governing body or a big football club, you need to spend quite a bit of money on doing digital media well if you want to benefit from it. And you look at the size of some of the digital teams at bigger clubs, big governing bodies, and you look at it in American sports. I mean, it's vast. It's a vast enterprise, and it takes a lot of people to do the kind of stuff that we all take for granted in terms of the content that you find out there really well. You know, it's not easy, and you've got to invest in it. But the upsides in terms of that positive face you can put out for your organisation and some of the commercial upsides, you know, they're ever growing.
Now, as you say, you worked as the ECB's head of new media up until 2015. So you mentioned Lord's website there, but it was very much sort of brave new world, wasn't it? A lot of new material was coming out. I know you started, involved in the launch of the ECB on Twitter and Facebook, the ECB apps as well. So it was very much, you didn't necessarily know what would work when you get on it, do you?
No, and I think some people would look at the ECB and cricket and think, well, that's not the kind of organisation that's going to take any risks. But, you know, we broke a lot of new ground. We were the first to do live video streaming, if you can call it that. That's back in the late 90s, and it was kind of more broken up, joined up still images rather than live video streaming, because obviously the bandwidth wasn't there and people couldn't play it. But we did live audio with the BBC of TMS via our websites then before 2000. So, you know, that's going back some. But yeah, we tried a lot of things out. We were the first governing body to really use apps on iPhones and to pull in a decent audience there. And we won some awards off the back of it, which was nice. And we tried to push the boundaries with video. And it's never easy in that world, because there are all kinds of things stopping you doing everything you want to do. A lot of it is rights issues. You're working with your broadcasters. There's lots of things you can't put out, even in your own stadiums. You know, you obviously can't live stream matches that are being broadcast, but, you know, you can't even point a camera at your own pitches during a match and take lots of photos. So, you know, it's not always easy. And you've never got enough people to do all the things you want to do. And if you're running, digital media for any organisation, you've never finished. You've never got to the point where you think, right, that's it, I can pack up and go home now. Because there's always something else you can do to improve your website, add a bit of content, take another bit of video, put out another tweet, add another infographic. There's always something nagging at you to think, oh, yeah, I could just do that, get somebody else to do that, you know. So good and bad about being involved in that sports world. But yeah, I loved it. It's fantastic. You know, if you can't play sport, you want to be a sports journalist. And I carried on doing that in the growing digital world of the last 20 years. Where it's going to go over the next 10, 15, 20 years, what we might be sitting here talking about, you know, in that time, heaven knows.
Well, I mean, certainly, because there's as many failures along the way in terms of social media and new media as there are successes. I mean, MySpace came and went, and I suppose it's getting on to what the next big thing is before it's blown up.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. So for those that remember MySpace, yes, that was there, and it got rather blown out of the water by Facebook, which has done rather well. So we've had other little social networks like Vine come and go over the years. Those big ones seem like they're here to stay. And maybe it's more about the technology that's going to be used to be able to plug into them. So, you know, if you had to pick one thing that's going to take off over the next 10 years, I'd say it's virtual reality and how that's going to become more mainstream to the point where, you can follow it via all your digital channels, and it's starting to be tested out a bit more thoroughly. Again, coming from the US sports market, so I was reading this week about a big push to put out the NBA All-Star Game later this basketball season, using some fantastic courtside technology. So, you know, if you've got the headset and you've got the bandwidth and you can do it, you'll be able to tap in and watch the game as if you were sitting courtside in the best seats, or watching it from, you know, behind the hoop, or watching it from up the top of the stadium. So maybe it's not too much of a leap to think somewhere further down the line, some of those big clubs, the ones that sell out their stadiums all the time, will start selling VR season tickets, and you can sit there and you can't get into Old Trafford to watch because they've sold out. You can't get in to see the Knicks play in New York. You can buy an online VR season ticket and sit there, you know, as if you were next to Woody Allen courtside and watch the basketball game. You know, I'd still rather be there myself. But if you can't get there for whatever reason, I think that's the way it's going to go. And I think we're also going to see more and more live video coming via social media. Facebook and Twitter are dipping their toes into it more and more. Whether Facebook will be there bidding for the next round of broadcast rights for the Premier League, and you might, as well as having Sky, BT, and you're going to have to start getting more and more channels up and running if you want to see all your team's games. Go along and watch it in person. I still think it beats it, and follow social media while you're at the stadium. Still a better way to do it.
We talked there about new media. Is it the be all and end all? Is printed media going the way of the dodo? TV, and then sounding a death knell here, is radio on its way out as well?
No, I think radio has thrived off the back of digital media, because it allows, you know, yourselves and others to tap into a whole new audience, and it allows people to follow it, you know, in so many different ways, via apps on your smartphone and your tablet. And I think, you know, I think we just need to change our definitions of what television is, what radio is. You know, it's increasingly video and it's audio that you're following via a whole plethora of digital channels and devices. I don't think any of those are going to die. Digital media, yeah. Traditional media, yeah, it's struggled, but good traditional media has found new platforms and new voices, and the audiences for big print newspapers in this country online are still huge. Sadly, people aren't buying as many black and white copies off the newsstands as they used to. You know, I miss that, but I don't do it sometimes. It's a cost, and if you can dip onto a website and see the same content for free, then, you know, it's tempting for some people. So whether newspapers will still be going in the same form they are now in 20 years' time, you'd have to say it's doubtful. But I'm sure that those media organisations will still be out there running and producing their content. They're just putting it out there, and you're consuming it in a totally different way.
So if people want help with their social and new media, journalism, etc., what can you do for them? How do they get in touch with you, Julian?
I have a website, unsurprisingly, Julian Good, with an E on the end, .co.uk, and I'm on Twitter if you want to follow me, @JulianGood with an E on the end. I'm out there helping sports bodies, businesses in Brentwood, Essex, wherever you are. You need some help with making a website run a bit smoother, having better content, managing the social media content, knowing what channels work for you, then yeah, come and have a chat. Very happy to talk to people about that.
All right, thank you very much for joining me, Julian Good. You'll be able to hear that website later on the Phoenix FM. We'll be able to hear that website. Be able to hear that interview later on the Phoenix FM website. Talking too much about new media. Later, www.phoenixfm.com.